The panel is Keeping Cthulhu Scary. Charlie Crank is not available to be on the panel because he had a prior engagement and did not find out that he was on the panel until too late. So the panel is just a seminar with me. I guess what I will do is briefly talk about what I see as an answer to the question, the answer, and then throw it open for questions, people to talk about their own experiences, whatever it happens to be. My name is Kenneth Hite, for the none of you who don't know me. I've written, and for the listening audience, I've written Trail of Cthulhu for Pelgrane Press, I've written Cthulhu 101, and Tour to Lovecraft, The Tales for Atomic Overmind, both works of greater or lesser degree of Lovecraftian criticism. Cthulhu 101, more lighthearted and humorous. In that vein, I've also written Where the Deep Ones Are, The Antarctic Express, and Clifford the Big Red God, three Cthulhu Mythos parodies of children's books, which contribute, perhaps, to the perception that Cthulhu can no longer be scary because people keep doing ridiculous children's book parodies using it, and plush toys, and cartoons, and South Park episodes, and on and on and on. The implication being, for these people, that nothing can be scary once it has been in a cartoon form or has been funny. This would come as a great shock to anyone who has ever watched horror since, say, The Munsters aired. Or been scared by Let the Right One In after Count Chocula was marketed. The reason horror works is that the fears it represents are eternal. They tap into something that is always present. Vampires can always be done badly or well. Werewolves can always be done badly or well, regardless of how much humor is in The Howling Part 4, regardless of how much sappiness is in Twilight. Vampires and werewolves can always be made scary again. They can even combine humor and horror, black horror in, say, Ginger Snaps or After Dark, or rather Near Dark, the greatest vampire movie before, basically between Horror of Dracula and Let the Right One In. So I would begin to say that the fundamental premise of the question, as usually posed, is flawed. The other way I know that it is flawed is no one has ever come up to me and said, I don't find Cthulhu scary. They've always said, I'm worried other people won't find Cthulhu scary because of all the plush toys. Now, there are people who said, I don't find Cthulhu scary because I'm a critical moron, but that's a different argument. That's that I've never found Cthulhu scary. I'd read it at a subliterate grade level and I can't understand Lovecraft's prose, whatever it happens to be. But once you understand Cthulhu, finding him scary is merely a matter of reading or consuming or participating in a media that presents that terror as well as Lovecraft presented it. And that is the fundamental key that I would sort of pivot into, is that finding anything scary, be it Cthulhu or a Saint Bernard or a vampire, is dependent on the presentation and dependent on the skill of the auteur, the director, the writer, the game master, the game designer, whatever it happens to be. And that skill also depends fundamentally on your willingness to enter into the artistic contract that you enter into with any art form, which is, I am going to engage this art form on the level that it was presented to me, or at least I'm going to begin to attempt that. Now, obviously, there are movies like The Unnameable 2, or Cthulhu Mansion, or on and on and on, that regardless of how much goodwill you bring to them, they're not going to scare you because they're just crap. There is nothing any more sophisticated in probably two-thirds of Cthulhu Mythos film than, you know, the cat jumping out at you in Alien. And if Alien had peaked with the cat jumping out of you, we would not think of it as a terrifying film, which it is, because it is a Lovecraftian film. It works on the exact same messages that Lovecraft sent, especially with Shadow over Innsmouth, especially with Thing on the Doorstep. It's the fear of body horror from the outside. Something outside is poisoning us. We don't know it. It's already changed us. It's already killed us. We're just walking around waiting to discover what's inside us. John Carpenter does that with The Thing. Again, classic Lovecraftian horror presented in a classic Lovecraftian metier and idiom. And still terrifying, regardless of how many times you've made jokes about testing people's blood with the Petri dish and the hot wire, regardless of how many times you've played Are You the Werewolf, regardless of how many times you've trivialized the fundamental message of The Thing. So, regardless of how many cartoons you've seen, how many plush toys you own, how many Cthulhu dice games you've played, the fundamental concept of Cthulhu remains as terrifying as you are willing to experience and as the creator is capable of presenting. And that is the sort of my theoretical, you know, theses that I'm nailing to the door, is that there is nothing inherently unscary about Cthulhu as opposed to anything else in the litany of horror tropes that we still are capable of finding scary. So with that as my general sort of challenge, I guess let's do maybe a, if anyone's got any specific questions, try and answer those and then riff on that. So does anyone have any specific questions about keeping Cthulhu scary? Yes, young man.
We know that Stephen King and some others have talked about being influenced by Lovecraft. But do you find anything about Lovecraft's work dated now when you look at it? Or do you think that it still stands up?
I think any artist who is dealing with their own times is going to come across to some extent as dated, just like Dracula can come across as dated, or Frankenstein, or The Werewolf of Paris, or any of the other great classics. There are elements of Lovecraft that are harder to read in 2011 than they were in 1928, and that is simply because we are not as consumed by the Yellow Peril as Lovecraft was. We are reading something like At the Mountains of Madness, not as a techno-thriller, but as a period piece, and that's simply because we are in the 21st century. Lovecraft wrote that in 1931. So when he presents cutting-edge science and cutting-edge technology, we read it in pretty much the same voice that we read Jules Verne, as a retro experience, a sort of a kitsch nostalgia is one of the great risks of reading anything set in the past, whether it be, you know, At the Mountains of Madness or whether it be 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. This is part of your responsibility as a consumer of horror, as a consumer of any art, is to try and approach it in the level that they're talking. You can't criticize Nosferatu, Murnau's Nosferatu, because it's not in color. You can't criticize Dreyse's Vampyr because it is filmed in an idiom that we no longer film things in. That would be tantamount to saying no movie made before The Godfather can be as good as any movie made after The Godfather. That's just ridiculous. So since the argument... But that said, it is definitely, it takes some degree of work to get back to 1931 and to read Lovecraft without having those moments happen to you. I find that as you read Lovecraft more often, those elements drop out. You know, when you're reading Frankenstein the third time, you're no longer surprised that it's all written in 19th century diction, right? When you read Dracula the third time, you're no longer laughing at the notion of a gramophone record. Right, you are reading then for the story and the fundamental terror of contagion and taint that Dracula is. And when you are reading Lovecraft for the second and third time, you no longer pay attention to the Dornier Wall seaplane or to the boat full of half-breeds or whatever it happens to be. You are now consumed, again, if you are intentionally trying to consume the horror as horror, you are now consumed with the fundamental existential terror that Lovecraft is talking about. And that existential terror is not only not dated, it is ever more relevant to the 20th and 21st centuries because Lovecraft is the first writer to actually try and deal with the horrors of modernity, which is to say something implacable and uncaring that will destroy us, right? He depersonalizes the horror, he takes it outside human experience, and he explains that it is still going to destroy us no matter what happens. that we are a fly speck. He is taking horror from Darwin, he's taking horror from Haeckel, he's taking horror from Rutherford and Shapley, from notions of geology and astronomy and biology that take humanity off of center stage. And he says, if we're not important, if nothing in the universe cares about us, that means we can be destroyed at any time without malice. Or if something does it maliciously, we have no recourse. And that's the terror that Lovecraft is talking about in a world where people are scared of global warming, or they're scared of terrorism, or they're scared of bird flu, or they're scared of any sort of impersonal threat that will destroy us, the threats of the modern age, or they're just scared about being, you know, dehumanized by technology, or they're scared of, you know, immigrants, which of course is something Lovecraft was scared of as well. Those fears of something larger than you, something you cannot control by political, social, theological means, that will end your existence, end your Providence, Rhode Island. That is a fear that is pretty much exclusive to the modern age. Before that day, people had plenty to do being afraid of syphilis and Romanians. So there was no immediate need for a cultural cataclysmic level of horror. And what I think Lovecraft does also is he modernizes the Gothic. He takes the Gothic out of castles and clanking chains and mysterious strangers, and takes it into archaeological sites and strange meteors and people who have been brainwashed or hypnotized or otherwise altered without their consent, perhaps. And these are things that are fundamentally modern scientific terrors as opposed to supernatural terrors. And that's, again, part of the thing that makes Lovecraft more readable now than I think a lot of his contemporaries are, and that a lot of other excellent, other horror masterpieces are. That's what makes Lovecraft eternal. Anybody else? Another question to launch me off on a tirade?
Well, I will keep prodding you in the rants here if you want.
No, feel free. I mean, everyone should feel free to, you know, have their own prods ready if they want.
Well, actually, I was going to continue that by saying that at a certain point, some literature, actually, it's not that it's quaint, it's rather it's very appropriate that reading it in the context of what era they're in. In other words, I would not want to read Sherlock Holmes and from what is important to him and what his world is if it suddenly became modern to me, you know, and trying to address my world. I like the fact that you go back into, you know, Victorian England and everything that exists for him, and then he has to deal with it in that context. So I'm not upset because Lovecraft is writing in the era that he is, because Cthulhu, it doesn't only exist there. In other words, it exists, you know, it's in many different eras and ages. And I think why that seems interesting, this is what I want you to address, is that the part of the horror is this benign world of, say, a library suddenly becomes an unspeakable horror because there's a book you're not supposed to know about or read that you discover that starts to make you go crazy. So in a room that might not really suggest that it's a Gothic horror situation, or that it's evil or anything else, all of a sudden a discovery triggers something and opens a door that, you know, you're not supposed to go down.
Yeah, I think that notion of the horror both of and behind the quotidian is something that horror has really been going toward, not to be teleological, but it has, since the beginning, since Horace Walpole said, I'm going to write, literally, what did he say? It was like a ghost story with the characteristics of a modern romance. And so what he did was he took the ghost story and put it into what for him was contemporary social terms. And Mary Shelley did that the next level. Dracula does it the next level, taking the horror out of Europe and bringing it to next door. Arthur Machen does the same thing, locating the horror in London. Lovecraft then turns that, you know, up to 11, makes it a mastery, makes the horror about everybody's backyard, everybody's next door. Every hill in New England potentially now holds some sort of horrific secret. Every back shelf of a library in a New England college might hold the Necronomicon. And Stephen King then, of course, takes it the next level down, where a beer commercial basically is what the lives of Stephen King characters are, and also there is the devil, or whatever it happens to be. So this approach to horror, it's not the only strand of horror, certainly, but it's a very significant one, is one that Lovecraft drives and Lovecraft pioneers. And when you talk about Sherlock Holmes's concerns being Victorian concerns, and his the reason that that works because he's part of his time, this is true. But the other thing that Sherlock Holmes works is because the notion of someone who's capable of sociopathically putting emotion aside and looking at something logically is an interesting character that we want to have on our side. No, we don't necessarily want to meet him or hang out with him, but we want to know that he's there taking care of business. And for example, the BBC adaptation of Sherlock to the modern era has met with some critical success. And, of the three episodes, one of them is actually pretty terrific. So it's possible to do a contemporary look at Sherlock Holmes as long as you focus on the central aspect of Holmes. You could do the same thing with Cthulhu, and since Cthulhu is explicitly transcendent of time and space, it's easier to do Cthulhu that way and to try and approach that. And you're absolutely right that the terror of the quotidian is one of the ways to keep Cthulhu scary. There's a short story by China Miéville called Details, which I believe was in Children of Cthulhu, and maybe the second or third best Cthulhu mythos story that is not by Lovecraft. And it is almost literally a story about being afraid of nothing. Someone begins to see significant cracks in the sidewalk, and notices that those cracks make a pattern that extends through everything they see. And that is exactly what you're talking about, the horror of the quotidian, the notion that this Lovecraftian cosmic horror, Cthulhu, can be and is behind everything, that our perceptual world, our comforting perceptual world, our benign world, to use your phrase, is just a facade. It's just a scrim, and behind that, there's monsters, there's awfulness, or worse yet, to Lovecraft, there's nothing. Right, you tear aside the scrim, and there's just a gaping cosmic void.
Someone, I can't remember who, but someone described it beautifully as Lovecraft wrote horror stories that would scare atheists. But the question I would have, though, is that since Cthulhu's out there in the commonplace, and like you said, it's on everybody's name, everybody knows this, the idea. How do you take it back? How do you bring him back into the realm of horror? And since he's been brought out in the limelight, and he worked better where it was just something that was whispered at, there was you only heard bits and pieces of, but you never quite understood it.
I think that, again, you're looking at a little bit of a false premise. I don't want to say it's a completely false premise, because obviously people can have a sense of overfamiliarity with a topic, with Lovecraft or with Cthulhu or with vampires. But there's two ways around that, and the one is just to sort of own it and drive straight through it. That would be the let the right one in approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, going in, certainly if you saw the movie in America, going in that it's a vampire movie. And let the right one in just sort of nails everything that means to the wall. This is a young girl who subsists entirely on human blood and by warping human servants into doing her will. And as you establish the truth, the fundamental, you can't hide from it, you can't laugh about it, you can't ignore it, truth about that, you scare the bejesus out of the audience. The other way to do that is the misdirection, the indirection, what you're talking about, the moving it back into the shadows, the deniability, the maybe that wasn't a vampire at all, maybe the people are just, having mental episodes. There's a great there's a great movie by George Romero, and I believe it's called Martin. It's about a guy who is or is not a vampire. And it is never established in the course of the movie whether he's a vampire or just a sick individual. And it is a terrifically scary movie, explicitly because it denies the reality of vampirism and breaks your expectations, and the cross doesn't work, and the garlic doesn't work, and things don't work, and none of your expectations are ever met, and he might actually just be a deranged sex fiend, or he might be a vampire. You just don't know for sure, and that is the way that they did it, that two great directors have done vampires. So for Lovecraft, you can go the same two ways. You can go full bore. What does it mean that there is an alien being the size of a mountain at the bottom of the Pacific that if it ever rolls over in its sleep, to say nothing of wakes up, it will destroy human civilization? And what does it mean that there are lots of those mountains at the bottom of the Pacific? He's just one. He may be the slightly largest mountain, but there is a race of those things. And it's at the bottom of the Pacific where we cannot go except under very special permission from the laws of physics. And when that permission is revoked for an instant, we are crushed like ants. And that, you just bring that and drive it down and force that knowledge into people. You don't let them get away with, you know, cheap jokes about calamari or South Park references or whatever it happens to be. You simply drive that truth home, that the world's existence relies on this thing not rolling over. And you can bring that metaphorically, you can bring that directly, you can have, you know, earthquakes and tsunamis. I mean, the Lord knows in the last 2 or 3 years we have plenty of tsunami footage. If you're looking for a way to terrify people, and anyone who can make, you know, calamari jokes after they look at Fukushima or they look at Sumatra or they look at Bangladesh is just not paying attention. And you are not doing your job right if you can't scare them with the thought that that can happen to Los Angeles and to you know, Santiago, Chile, and to Sydney, Australia, and to Tokyo, and to Singapore, and to Hong Kong. And that's just the first rollover, right, is that. Meanwhile, you know, simultaneously you have cults that make the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda look like choir boys. You have maniacs sailing around with weapons and access to some sort of esoteric truth. It's like, you know, Somali pirates with an A-bomb is basically what these guys are. And you just keep bringing everything about the modern world that Lovecraft would hate and fear and despise, and that you also secretly or not so secretly hate and fear and despise, and you bring it to Cthulhu's doorstep, and you tell your players or your viewers or your readers that this is what is going on because billions of years ago, before you even got a vote, a mountain fell into the earth and briefly destroyed everything before going to sleep. And we are between buzzes on its snooze alarm right now. And when you can bring that, then, if they're not terrified, you know, someone dropped the ball, but it wasn't Cthulhu and it wasn't Lovecraft. Now, the other way is to go around with the subtlety, with the, oh, Cthulhu, that's nonsense. That was just a thing written by H.P. Lovecraft. It's just crazy talk. No one ever believes in that. It's a cartoon. It's a serial. It's a plushie. It's a children's book. And as the players go through their lives and discover that nonetheless there are an awful lot of weird deaths and people with only, you know, with little webs in between their fingers, and there's that one serial killer who was actually really scarily close to stuff that was in a Lovecraft story that only like 50 people have read in a fanzine, and this and that and the other thing, and you start piecing it together, and, you know, they turn on South Park and the episode starts to jiggle and shake and move out, and suddenly it's replaced by a bulletin from the government about an earthquake. And it's like, why did that happen just then? Is that a coincidence? Is that a signal? Is that an omen? And ideally, the players will drive themselves crazy, or the reader will drive himself crazy, trying to find connections that you just always remove one by one while keeping the world around them ever so coarse, ever so rough, ever so dangerous, ever so rugose, to coin a phrase. And it is their continued apperception that the comforting reality, the benign reality that includes H.P. Lovecraft, genteel racist, and South Park, and plush toy Gugs, is actually just the thing underneath whatever's pushing that into existence, right? That all that is the scab, is the part of the world that is just right now flaking away as we begin to touch that reality. And our first response, just like a mouse struck by the sight of a hawk, is to freeze and hope it goes away. And the way that we do that is to create these comforting illusions. Oh, it doesn't exist. Oh, Lovecraft was a racist. Oh, it's a cartoon. Oh, isn't it funny? Well, all right, it's funny that first time, but then that slowly turns into, is this really a joke? Isn't a joke an awful lot like a scream when you just sort of analyze it, anatomically speaking? Laughter and choking to death, aren't they kind of the same thing? Isn't there a connection? And you come in around it the sideway. And those are basically the two ways to attack any sort of trope. If you're lucky, there exists a formula, and you can just sort of lay the cards out, and that is something like Horror of Dracula, or that is something like, to a large extent, Near Dark, where everyone knows that this is how vampire movies go. Bam, 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 bam. And if you play those cards really well, and they're really good cards, then you create a good story. And that is the way that most Cthulhu Mythos authors and auteurs do it, is they say, you find an old document, it is creepy, you go to a library or haunted house or abandoned fish cannery or whatever it happens to be, and there's a guy in a mask, and then he eats you, and that's how it plays out. And if you play those cards well, then you don't mind that you've basically been given a formula story. And if they play them badly, then you're like, I can see this one coming a mile down the road, and you ignore it. So I don't want to denigrate the notion of the formula, because the formula exists for a reason, and that reason is it reliably supports the story you want to tell. But to really, what you're talking about, reclaim it, bring it back, you have to break those expectations one way or the other. And you either have to break them through great truth or through great lies.
And I find the subtle way, a great way to do it, if your players are already, and start with their joke. Yeah, it's a plush toy, but why do the eyes keep changing color? If you've read Catch-22, you have the best classic formula to do it. It starts off as a joke, and then the laughs and the jokes start becoming very hollow, and suddenly you realize, oh my God, he really does have a dead body in the tent. And that is truly horrifying. And the guys who don't pay attention, well, that's what insanity is all about. And a quick death. Nothing brings your players, in my experience, back to the horror of everything than a quick death for the first character, so they can start again the next week.
It does focus the mind wonderfully. To be shot at with results, to paraphrase George Washington.
Or they're insane. They come up against it, and their character just can't cope with it, and then suddenly realize you're serious about it. You really are going to drive them insane or kill them. What? And you can give them clues. You can give them a chance to save themselves. But they can't. Don't be afraid to just do that.
We have a player in a CLC game that or anything with horror who has read everything. Even your books.
Yeah.
And everything, and knows it all. If they, what we call it, if you could kill it with this, or whatever you do, and to remove it from the problem. And how you, I know that, you know, you can change the thing around and stuff like that, but other than that, it's sort of a bit frustrating, especially with myself not really about the genre. Yeah.
Well, if you say you can just change things around, but don't underestimate just changing things around. I mean, a vampire who doesn't mind sunlight is a scarier vampire than a vampire who blows up when he gets sunlight on him. That was true when, you know, Bram Stoker had Dracula wandering around in the sunlight. That's true now. That said, the classic monsters of the mythos are grotesquely dangerous on their own ground. There are very few of them that have a silver bullet, right? You may say, oh yeah, Shoggoths take full damage from electricity. Okay, a Shoggoth has a lot of damage it can be taking. While it is doing that, it can grow fangs. Okay, fangs. Claws. All right, claws. Rootlets. What do you mean rootlets? Things that grow into your skin and, you know, burrow through your larger veins and arteries. You mean burrow? Yeah, burrow, like a tiny rat. What do you mean, like a tiny rat? Like a tiny rat. It's a Shoggoth. It can make anything. Anything organic. It can make that fish that swims up your urethra. and then it can stay attached to a Shoggoth, and it can expand or grow spines on that. It's a Shoggoth. Think about this. And you're like, oh yeah, electricity. Go ahead, lick that D-cell. That'll help you out. You know, whatever it happens to be, these things are awful. Or let's take deep ones who are actually not even bulletproof particularly. You know, they've got thick scales of an integument. So, you know, maybe they take a little less damage from about 45 than a normal human being. But, you know, two or three shots, center of mass, that'll take a deep one down. Well, deep ones didn't last 100 million years by walking up to you in broad daylight when you're obviously holding a gun. Deep ones attack you when you're down in the sewer, because you have to go down in the sewer, because they kidnap your wife or daughter or girlfriend or mistress or whoever it happens to be that you would follow someone down into a sewer for. And they know that because they're telepathic and they know everything about human weaknesses, especially sex and greed. And oh, that's right, that's all humans have, those weaknesses. Deep ones can play on those things. They can always get you down in the sewer. They can get you into the abandoned hydrotherapy chamber of the insane asylum. They can come up through the sewer. Guess what connects to the sewer? Oh, that's right, everything. Yes, okay, right. They're not bulletproof. Did you bring your shotgun to the can? I don't think you did. I mean, these things do not play fair. It is not a skirmish miniatures game. Call of Cthulhu, one of the great things about it, one of the great unsung things about it, is that it has facing modifier, no range chart, no miniatures, right? I mean, we all had miniatures when we played Call of Cthulhu, but no one ever, you know, said, oh, look at that, thank God the deep one's 40 feet away and you can't get me. The deep one is always closer than you thought he was. So if you're saying, you know, again, I guess I go back to my previous answer, you know, just bear down unregretfully and crush them with these monsters, which are legitimately designed to crush you. Or sneak around the side, lie, say, well, I guess that wasn't a Byakki then. Or, you know, this mummy just seems to suck the flames into it. And fire is now catching all around it. It's like it has a tiny little dimensional portal inside. Or whatever it is you happen to want to do to mess with the silver bullet, metaphorically speaking, that this guy carries for everything. Or do a change-up, okay? It's, you know, it's a servant of Nyarlathotep, the god of a thousand faces. Maybe it looks like a dimensional shambler, but it's actually, you know, a hound of Tyndalos. Or maybe it's a hound of Tyndalos, but it resembles a space eater from Frank Belknap Long. It hasn't bothered to take material form, or it's been dematerialized. It's a color out of space, which has no weaknesses. It's a horrible ball of radioactivity, and you can't do anything to it. I mean, there's a million things in Lovecraft and in the sort of Cthulhoid horror genre that the fundamental horror of them is that you cannot influence them. Now, again, in a game, as we come out of adventure games and think, well, if there's treasure in the room, we have to be able to kill the orcs. That's how the rules work. The treasure is the knowledge that the room is full of a horrible radioactive color that you should have avoided. And by the time you're fighting it, you've already lost.
Yeah.
So the goal, then, is not to defeat the color out of space. The goal is to tell the story of how the color out of space only killed those first five guys. And the rest of the guys, you know, blew up the building and salted the ground with, you know, concrete, you know, and cadmium rods, or whatever it was that they did. So, you know, when you're asking, you know, If your player is feeling cocky, you are, and if he is willing, if he's playing Call of Cthulhu, you have license from myself, from Sandy Peterson, and from Howard Phillips Lovecraft to drive that Shoggoth right up his urethra.
Is there a chart for that?
Oh, yeah.
Can I comment?
Grey's Anatomy as hip location table.
Comment, if you would, on this idea. One of the reasons I think that Dracula and Frankenstein have been accepted in a more mainstream manner is that they don't threaten our perception of ourselves. They don't negate the fact that humans are the top sentient being and that we control our destiny, that we were made in the image of God, and these guys are screwing with it, and we can deal with that. People can deal with Frankenstein and Dracula. But Lovecraft is saying, we're just insects. And someone's going to just step on us like we do with them. We don't give it any more thought than that. And you aren't the top dog. You're not the, you do not, you know, have any existence beyond, you know, what an insect would have in its world. So right there, there's no sympathy from humans about, wow, this is a great story for us. And what you just said about, no, there are a lot, most of these things you're not going to be able to deal with in any way because you lack the power and the knowledge to deal with them. All you can do is minimize the damage and temporarily delay your inevitable doom. And because of that, you know, it's like,
gee, it's rather depressing. It's like, you know.
And the lucky ones are the ones who go insane so they don't have to worry about it, right? So you see what I'm saying in terms of the way the two different horrors are approached and how you fit in as the reader and what you're paying attention to? It's like...
Fritz Leiber famously said that Lovecraft caused a Copernican revolution in horror because the horror no longer comes from Earth, from humanity, from human concerns. The horror now comes from space, from alienness, from inhuman concerns. And Lovecraft is not quite the first person to do it. Arthur Machen certainly does about as good a job of that as anyone ever has in The Great God Pan. But Lovecraft is absolutely the first person to do it three times in a row. And he definitely gets the poem any more than Copernicus was obviously prefigured by Nicholas of Cusa and Aristarchus of Samos and all these other guys. But Lovecraft is the guy who nails it down and makes it stick. And there are ways to detourn vampires, Dracula, or golems, Frankenstein, into inhuman concerns. But it is a change from their initial approach. And you're right that those things are parodies of mankind and are, as a result, the human reader can feel an ironic distance from those things in a way that a human reader cannot feel to Cthulhu. The interesting thing about that is that it becomes very, very difficult to tell a compelling human story about Cthulhu or about these things because the question of where do you as the reader fit into this story becomes paramount at that point. And if the character has a human response to the horror, he is in a way assimilating it into human experience. And if the entire point of the story is that it cannot be assimilated into human experience by a rational person, and the reader theoretically is still rational, it becomes very, very difficult. And the fact that Lovecraft manages to pull it off a dozen times of bringing people into this folie à deux with the reader so that by the time you've gotten to the ending and you're saying, no, you fool, it's fungus people. Fungus people are behind the record. You don't realize how crazy you sound. Right? But Lovecraft has done that to you, and he does it to you over and over and over. And the reason I think that it feels different is because for all of our vaunted modernity and distancing and, oh, well, aliens don't scare us anymore because we've seen Star Wars, there is still a fundamental disconnect. And we are probably still waiting for someone who is as good at writing character as Shirley Jackson was to write a Cthulhu mythos story. Because that is probably who it would have to take to make us really honestly understand what goes through a human being's mind at the moment that it impacts the outside and disintegrates. And when you read Haunting of Hill House or you read We Have Always Lived in the Castle, there is someone who understands human psychology, right? But, you know, sadly, she did not write a Lovecraft story, and so we don't have that. And we are probably, and this is one of my sort of points as to why Frankenstein and the vampire are fundamentally different from werewolves, is there was never a masterpiece about a werewolf, right? The Werewolf of Paris is A, about a ghoul, not about a werewolf, and B, not very good. Our werewolf masterpieces have only been films, and that doesn't count. And Lovecraft wrote several masterpieces, but they are short and they are oblique and they are indirect, as we were saying earlier. And so you almost never get a sympathetic human understanding of what it is like to slam into the outside of the world, because Lovecraft does not write very many sympathetic humans. Color Out of Space being possibly the only example, and there again it's deliberately distanced by being told to the narrator by someone who heard about it from the guy who saw it happen. It's at fourth hand by the time it gets to the narrator, which means it's fifth hand when it gets to us. Compare that to Dracula, which is in the first person. I met Dracula and oh my god. Right? Or Frankenstein. I made Frankenstein and oh my god, right? I made the monster. And so there is a immediacy to those narratives that Cthulhu is missing still. And it may not be possible, but it, I think it should be for someone of better insight into human psychological character than Lovecraft had. He is a terrific writer on many levels, but as a limner of the human spirit, he perhaps falls a little short. But the perception that you see between as a difference between the two, that's absolutely Lovecraft's intent, and I think it's absolutely critical consensus about one of the differences between Lovecraft and the post-Lovecraft horror and pre-Lovecraftian horror.
Do you think it's more believable? In other words, if you're trying to tell about somebody going mad, do you think it's easier to make that believable than someone saying, I'm going crazy, I'm going to tell you what it's like to go crazy?
I think it's easier to do that, but it's less powerful. The first person or the situation in which the reader is sitting on the protagonist's shoulder and looking into his mind, looking out through his eyes. Poe, for example, was able to very convincingly portray people who are going insane and then sort of communicate that like typhoid to the reader. Lovecraft was less convincingly able to do it. He discovered it not quite early enough in his career that he couldn't write that as well as Poe, and then he finally stopped trying. But we are really missing someone who's able to do that well. Robert Bloch was able to do sort of that. I mean, he was a good journeyman attempt at it. Ray Bradbury has occasionally touched on it. There's people who've done, you know, Mind of the Madman type things, but most of those people are doing mad people who are driven insane by human concerns. You know, my mommy didn't love me enough, or I was beaten by nuns, or whatever it happens to be. The number of people who do it because they have discovered that the universe is a scrim and they have touched the outside of it is sadly limited.
Well, one thing that we're doing right now, I mean, we've been doing improvisational shows, which are specifically improvisational horror stories.
Okay.
And for the longest time, they've been, your stereotypical slasher type things. This year, we've been wanting to get more into this. I've always been a Lovecraft fan, so I've been trying to educate a lot of my fellow actors specifically about these tropes, these themes, to kind of get them up on stage. But what you're just saying was one of the biggest problems is that it was really, really hard to get a likable protagonist that the audience can really identify with. Specifically to be able to identify with that, because it all comes down to the point of it that they discover what the truth is, and then as far as that person's concerned, the story is over. Everything has changed. Nothing can ever be the same again. How would you, especially nowadays in this modern age, when we assume that we can understand everything, how would you approach that towards a modern audience that hasn't read Lovecraft, to be able to go along with the words, if you actually have to watch it or something like that?
I mean, if you're asking how I would try and get people to convey that emotion without having read the source literature, I'm not sure that's possible.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, talking about getting the actors to convey it. I mean, the job of an artist is to convey unfamiliar emotion to an audience, regardless of what they've read. Otherwise, art would be impossible. But I would say for the actors, what they would need to be able to do is either look at great performances of the sort of I forget who plays Eleanor in the movie The Haunting, the original movie, the Robert Wise The Haunting. Look at movies about Abel Ferrara's Addiction, actually, about a guy who discovers he's a vampire, and it is done in the same language as heroin addiction. Things like that. You want to look at narratives of personal apocalypse of all kinds. Jacob's Ladder, maybe. Although I don't know if you can get a psychological reality out of Adrian Lyne, and at least sort of get everyone's jangly mind thinking the right way. It occurs to me, having said that there aren't any good limiters of human psychology doing Lovecraft, that's actually not true. Ramsey Campbell is pretty close. So most of his great psychological stuff, sadly, is not his great Lovecraftian stuff. He sort of follows the Robert Bloch direction towards, you know, the inner space, not the outer space. Mm-hmm. But with The Face That Must Die, or The Doll That Ate Her Mother, or whatever it is, those are basically narratives of people who have been broken by society and are biting back. Very, very good stuff to look at and read. Again, I think that the thing to do, if you're trying to do cosmic horror on stage, and I'm an artistic associate for a troupe in Chicago called the Wild Claw Theater that has presented Dreams of the Witch House as a play, and William Peter Blatty's Legion, and a original play called Revenants about zombies, and Carmilla, the Sheridan Le Fanu vampire story. So they're wrestling with these same sorts of questions, and I think that portraying characters who are being destroyed is something that you just have to sort of, you know, look at how other actors have done it and think about what in your life would have to not be true for you to realize the rest of the universe wasn't true. And maybe work from that. I mean, I'm not an actor, so I'm barely a critic. So I don't know necessarily how you would go about that, but I would say, you know, it start from a personal apocalypse they can believe in, and then move that outward until they've got to an apocalypse that they can fake. And, you know, none of us in this room are genuinely concerned that crustaceans from Pluto are going to take our brains away, I'm pretty sure. thanks. But we are concerned, we are very much concerned that forces outside our control will remove our individuality. And you take that fear and you tap that and you represent it as a crustacean from Pluto, not as Gene Hackman in a dirty trench coat, and you suddenly have a different kind of a story. And you combine it with the tropes of The X-Files, right? A Whisper in the Darkness is a UFO story. Strange lights in the hills, possible abduction, blah, blah, blah. That's an X-File. Now, Kim Manners and company spent, you know, 9 seasons, of which 5.5 are great, showing how to present those kinds of encounters, those kinds of apocalypses. Look at Close Encounters and watch it as a tragedy, not a comedy. Right?
Yeah.
You know, but the way that Richard Dreyfuss collapses as the aliens get closer and closer to Richard Dreyfuss, that's the first 2/3 of a Lovecraft story. The fact that Steven Spielberg says, no, they're good aliens, oh, thank goodness. You know, think about what happens the scene after that when the, you know, light expands and all of Devil's Tower is alive with the color out of space. Or when the notes begin to spread across every human form of communication, like the zombie film Pontypool, where hearing the words turns you into a zombie. You know, think about what that kind of alien contact means if you don't have Steven Spielberg groveling to the memory of his 9-year-old self trying to get out of it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that's happening, and no one has done it yet because it's a scary, horrible story, and no one wants to watch that. We want to watch the Independence Day aliens that you can download on a Mac and kill.
Or they have this new series on TNT.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. You're Falling Skies aliens. And it's not that you can't get genuine horror out of alien invasion. I mean, obviously you can. It's just that it's not Lovecraftian horror. Cloverfield is somewhat close to Lovecraftian horror because it's never explained. You don't know what it is, and it's big and awful and doesn't seem to have any real purpose. I mean, that's a film about powerlessness, but it is not a masterpiece of a film about powerlessness. It's nowhere near as good as Close Encounters, for example. And it's human psychology is, you know, the worst kind of secondhand sketching. So,
talking is saying something that's disturbing some people. They wish he would shut up, because we went through this feel-good era where we sent out the satellite in space with our body, and this is us, come find us in this solar system, you know, and Hawking saying, you know, this is not necessarily a good idea, because our own personal experience is that every more advanced technology culture has always destroyed the less advanced technological culture on our planet. Why would it be any different? In other words, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, ha-ha, they blow up the planet Earth. But what if they come along and say, oh, yum, you know, not that we're eating us, it's like, oh, look at all these cool resources and everything, and these bugs or whatever are on it are just, you know, they're so primitive, it's like, who's going
to
miss them?
Or even if they don't have any malign intent, but due to us, what, you know, America did to Hawaii. Right? I mean, find one single actual worshiper of Pele. Find one actual single practitioner of the real traditional Hawaiian society. That society was destroyed and remade in the image of the Dole Pineapple Company and Southern Baptism. And that's what Hawaii is full of. It's an American state. Now, we are Americans, so we think that's awesome. And the Hawaiians probably, if they got to vote, would say, yeah, we'd probably rather be Americans than, you know, nothing. Or, you know, Japanese, which was the other option. But that society was deformed, reshaped, torn asunder, and is now commercialized. So even if the aliens mean us no harm whatsoever, and all they do is they park their space battleship in the orbit of Mars and just sit out there and, you know, talk to us on the internet, our culture will destroy itself in an attempt to sort of ape and conform to that culture. Look at the cargo cults. Look at all the messianic and millenarian movements about people, you know, when the whites come by with their cargo, and now we have to kill all of our cattle to show the gods that we really mean business. You know, the insanity of human reaction to other humans is going to be as nothing compared to the human reaction to aliens, and that's just simple extrapolation from history, as Dana points out. There's a great thing, I don't know if it was Hawking that said it, but it was someone who, if it wasn't, it was someone who said it in response to Hawking. The famous Fermi paradox, right? That if there's anyone out there, and we've had radio telescopes for so many years, and the galaxy is only so big, why haven't we heard them? And the answer is because any civilization that survives learns to shut up. They hide themselves. They cluster down. They hunker down like Lovecraftian protagonists. You know.
And they're
sitting in the dark with a shotgun.
Why are two people keeping quiet? There's really bad things out here. Shut up! Or other people are saying, no, it's okay. They're going to find them. They're going to ignore us and go to them.
I don't have to be faster than the Zeta Reticulans. I just have to be faster than you. The great thing about Lovecraft and Cthulhu is that the horror is literally the horror of modernity, and so anything that happens in modern science and modern speculation and transhuman culture is something that Lovecraft already said something about back in 1928. And, you know, when Hawking says, oh, that's right, maybe the universe is implacable, or maybe our own record says that all alien cultures destroy the less technologically advanced one they come in contact with. You know, Lovecraft said that in 1928 in Shadows Over Innsmouth. Because what happens when the less technologically advanced Massachusetts natives come in contact with the deep ones? Innsmouth is destroyed. Its culture is hollowed out and eaten away from within, and nothing is left except for horrible, bloated figures in the basement. That's what's going to happen to us. Lovecraft already said what Hawking was saying. Lovecraft already said what people are saying when they're drilling into the 10-million-year-old lake underneath the Antarctic ice, and they're like, gosh, I hope nothing comes out. It's like, yeah, great. Thanks, Russia. You haven't done enough damage yet. And everything that we read, everything that we see, you know, all these exoplanets, like 600, 700 planets now that we know about, that are all orbiting, you know, the stars all over the main sequence, but most of the planets are too hot and too big. And so it's like, okay, the average planet is hotter and bigger than we are. Whatever is out there is going to be more robust and stronger. That's just math, right? If anything comes off those things, and again, we know about life forms that live in sulfur dioxide vents in Antarctica, right? Volcanic vents at the bottom of the ocean under many, many, many tons of pressure. And there's life forms, there's whole ecologies that evolved there. So, yeah, you've got a whole planet, and it's a planet that's, you know, 900 degrees Fahrenheit or whatever it happens to be, and has five times our gravity. You know, you give those exotic bacteria on Earth a couple of shots, they'll build something. So just imagine what that planet's native life forms may have built. You know, the world, the universe is, to paraphrase Haldane, you know, not only stranger than we suppose, it's stranger than we can suppose. And Lovecraft is the guy who says, think about what that means for a second. Think about what something that is literally stranger than you can suppose implies. That your brain cannot get to that limit, right? It's like Eskimos discussing suntans, or, you know, how many words for downpour can you have if you've lived in the Gobi Desert your whole life? You simply can't wrap your head around it, much less invent an umbrella. It's just, there's no way to respond to it if you don't have the language, if you don't have the mental experience of that kind of thing. We don't have the mental experience of that kind of thing, and we never can, because we are, you know, stuck with the, you know, with the factory issue technology here. Our experiences are necessarily constrained by our biology. And Lovecraft's point is simply the biology, our biology is far from the only answer and far from the complete set. And there is no reason to assume, and in fact there is every reason not to assume, that we are the top of that particular set of rankings. Again, a universe in which everything else is dead is the happy ending from a Lovecraftian perspective. Because whatever, if there's one thing left alive, that means either it killed everything or it was tougher and smarter than everything. That's not good news. The notion that you can't find horror in Lovecraft, that you can't find horror in Cthulhu, that you can't find horror in cosmic truth, cosmic facts, you know, the science is settled, people, as we say. It's just ridiculous. And it doesn't matter how many, how many children's parody books I write, that's not going to take away the laws of physics.
Is there an element of trivializing or finding humor in horrible things that's a defense mechanism or a way of coping?
Oh, absolutely.
That's also the reason why there's a blush of Cthulhu. It's another way of dealing with it.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's taking it too seriously, too often.
Anyone who's ever known Jews or Irishmen knows that there is plenty of human instinct to make fun of horrible stuff. And there is no shortage of psychological research that says that a very standard response to stress is to is the comic instinct, to make it into the grotesque as opposed to the terrifying. And it's true psychologically, and it's certainly true literarily and culturally. I mean, maybe it's not true for some batch of islanders somewhere that people haven't studied or whatnot, but it's a pretty universal human trait to find the comic rather than confront the truly awful. I mean, gallows humor, black humor, it has those names for a reason. I think that it is probably, and I hate to say this, I hate to admit it, but I think it might be giving Lovecraft a little bit too much credit. And it's definitely giving his interlocutors too much credit to say that they have read Lovecraft and comprehended him, and that is why they are making jokes. I think it is much easier to say, and much more likely to say, that a mental construct, an image, a symbol, a trope, a meme that is sticky in more than one dimension. And for the same reason that people immediately began using gargoyles as editorial cartoons when they built the gargoyles for the Notre Dame de Paris in the 1840s. They had a sculptor, and they had him carving horrible, grotesque monsters. They put them up on Notre Dame during the restoration of Notre Dame in the 1840s, and people immediately started using them as cartoons and to sell ladies' underthings and whatever else people sold in Belle Epoque, France. that's the response of something that was created that has dimensionality and truth and heft and connection to it. And your immediate response to anything is, you know, if there's a beautiful woman, right? Some people will say, God, I'd like to have sex with that beautiful woman. And some people say, I'd like to, you know, find out, you know, I'd like to dress that beautiful woman, or I'd like to, you know, talk to her about what it means to be a beautiful woman, or I'd like to put her in a movie, or I'd like to do this or that or the other thing. No one's response to any single powerful image is the same in all cases to everybody. And a lot of our responses are, even if I want to have sex with that beautiful woman or dress her or put her in a movie, it's going to be a lot funnier if she's the one who walks into the wall or falls down the stairs and, you know, into the cream pies or the giant pile of mousetraps if you're Dario Argento. So there is going to be that level of response to anything. And I think that the desire to make the comic, make the grotesque out of Lovecraft's horror is partly it's the psychological response, and partly it's just that anything that you can grasp, anything, any symbol, can be used for anything. I mean, the postmoderns have a lot of problems, but they're certainly right about that. That you can, and a symbol that works, that is constructed out of whole cloth, like the gargoyles of Notre Dame or like Cthulhu, is one that is, I think, probably more plastic in a sense, that it can be more easily ported to another thing. You can put ninjas in anything, you can put dirigibles in anything, you can put robots in anything, you can put Cthulhu in anything. That's because ninjas, dirigibles, robots, Cthulhu are all powerful little symbols that we can do things with and that we can manipulate, and we like to do that. And so, you know, I believe that there is some degree of nervous laughter when we make fun of Cthulhu. I mean, I know there is for me, but there is... A lot of it is just that, you know, a squid-headed guy is hilarious, and it's awesome to put in places. You know, it's great fun to have, you know, Cthulhu have an eating disorder, like the Unspeakable. It's the French cartoon. If they're shown, someone will fix it in there. But the Cthulhu's the eating disorder is just, you know, it's hilarious. So is, you know, putting Cthulhu in South Park being scritched by, you know, Cartman, like the big dog in the Warner Brothers cartoons. That's just hilarious. It's just funny. And it is not because Trey Parker and Matt Stone are recoiling from the abyss. It's because they see a giant scary thing and a little annoying thing, and they say, oh, Warner Brothers did that. We can do that. And then so I think that there's a lot of... There's a lot of just sort of taking a trope that's out there and being able to use it that drives that.
What about putting hope into these types of stories or these, you know, things? Because a lot of these stories, they hit a certain level of fatalism, mm-hmm. where it's just like, okay, this is going to happen. And I'm kind of switching gears, taking it back into the game realm, mm-hmm. where your players are going to go, you know, okay, well, there's nothing that we can do. How can you throw carrots in that... Well, okay, it's not, you know, there is something that you can do. And then just so you can take it back from them. Is there, what would you recommend for giving them something, some small recourse of, that they're doing something at least?
I would start by looking at the stories in which Lovecraft's characters do that. For example, The Dunwich Horror is the classic example. But also in The Shadow Over Innsmouth, the government blows up Innsmouth. And that's good news for everybody. It doesn't take, but, you know, it looks pretty awesome while they're doing it.
It'll feel good afterwards.
The Shunned House, Lovecraft's Mary Sue protagonist, defeats the vampire werewolf ghost rubber monster in the basement. Case of Charles Dexter Ward, the second greatest horror novel ever written, in which Dr. Willett, against all odds, manages to defeat a 400-year-old sorcerer in a duel of magic. That's pretty terrific. There's a number of stories in Lovecraft in which that happens. And again, the way that I have done it in my own games, to leave this focused on games, is to use that example that I was talking about. We are existing on the sufferance of a mountain-sized being at the bottom of the Pacific. We are between buzzes of his snooze alarm, as I said earlier. Okay, if that's true, if we can forestall his rolling over by a century, that may only be a microsecond to Cthulhu. That may only be just an infinitesimal amount of time to him, but it's literally 7 billion centuries of human life that we've just saved. That's not cream cheese, right? That's pretty good. If we can forestall him by 10 years, that's not as good as a century, but it's a start, and it gives us 10 more years to maybe forestall it again. I mean, if the only thing that keeps Cthulhu from rising is us hitting his snooze alarm every 10 minutes, then let's start hitting that snooze alarm. And yeah, that'll make our arms tired. That'll be terrible. But again, the doomed struggle against implacable evil, that's King Arthur. That's the man who shot Liberty Valance. That's every great story in the Western tradition. And if they can't find the awesome in being the guys sent up to the wall to watch for zombies, to borrow from George R.R., then perhaps they need to get another hobby that doesn't involve adventure games.
Or a different role
play. Right, yeah.
I mean, you don't play Paranoia or Cthulhu because you want to get attached to your characters. Yeah. You know? If you're not going to go insane, you're going to go to the food bath.
But that, to me, I mean, this is far and far from keeping Cthulhu scary, but that, to me, is the fundamental reason the Call of Cthulhu is a fundamentally moral game. It's a game that has a genuine moral concern. Because the way to win is to sacrifice your life and sanity for other people. And the fact that you are doing that as your fun adventure of escapism is phenomenal. And the great thing about Call of Cthulhu, and to a lesser extent other Cthulhu games, is that it foregrounds that choice and gets your players to buy into the notion that, yes, we are going to go crazy or die, but we are doing it with our eyes open, and we are doing it for the town of Arkham, for the state of Massachusetts, for the United States of America, for the planet Earth, for the solar system, for the Sagittarius spiral arm, for whatever the scope is. And we're the guys who are out on the tip of the spear doing our jobs. And that's a pretty terrific feeling. And you can reward that feeling while ensuring that their mortgage is being foreclosed on, that their girlfriend has left them, that their parents are trying to get them committed, that the army is hunting them down because they stole the experimental electric lance, that every single element of the society that they are trying to protect is trying to destroy and expel them as you or I would a cancerous tumor. But that's just the breaks. And that, I think, is, you know, again, it's the fundamental story of human heroism going back to freaking Gilgamesh and Beowulf. Is you are the poor schmuck who gets to go down into the damn cave and rip people's arms off. And guess what's going to happen? You know, best case scenario, you'll get 10 years between monster fights. And then the dragon is going to roast your ass. Because there's always another dragon over the frickin' hill.
Because
the benefit package. That's right, yes. Yes, that's true. The pension plan at Miskatonic is actually still in balance. Odd. We have new people who have snuck in. We have 20 minutes left on the panel. Do any of the new people have a question? Or do any of the old timers, first comers?
I just want to say that I think it's interesting that you bring up scope. I mean, for me, the more in my role, as I role play more, the more and more I find it's important to make things personal.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly easy to and can run games that are just about defeating monsters and getting loot. But so when you were talking, I have to say that I was thinking more and more about making whether it would be I'm thinking of gaming. Spending a lot of time involved in making it personal, whether it's the town or whether it's your sister or whether it's your brother. So when we're talking about country, planet, you know, larger scope, to me, I find it harder and harder and harder, or I've not found it easy to make that scary. It becomes grand, and then you're wanting to launch bazookas at monsters and various things. I'm curious what in the games you've played that are scary and what scope that's usually at. Is it range, the whole range, or is it tends to be smaller or larger?
What I try to do is present a personal horror as a symptom of a cataclysm. Right? You know, the bees in your yard are dying. Okay, that's not cool. I like bees. They're awesome. They're little buzzy bees. Make honey. Well, they're dying. What are you going to do about it? Well, I don't know. Go ask an entomologist. Well, he says that there's some kind of bacteria that breeds argon that's in your bee colony. What? And you start building out from there, and eventually you say, oh, right, the bees actually just turn out to be one symptom. You know, I'm looking at one measles spot on a patient.
So you start.
Now, you care about, you still care about the bees in your backyard or your girlfriend or whatever it is, but the part of the cosmic in cosmic horror comes from at least a 1 second where the player's perspective is lifted up, the reader's perspective is lifted up, and you're like, Christ, that's one measles spot on a patient? We are boned.
Right.
You know, this goes way bigger than we thought. And that is, to me, the vertiginous cosmic aspect of it. Because if all you ever do is solve the mysterious problem of the argon fungus in your backyard, that might be exciting and intellectually challenging, and you might have had to fight an argon monster that, you know, came pouring up out of your basement, a la the shunned house. But if that is just a one-off thing, it becomes an exciting story of pest control. It does not become cosmic horror. And the part that makes it cosmic horror is when you realize that it is one measles spot, or that it is the tip of the hypodermic injecting evil into your body. And by your body, I mean reality. This is the thing, this is what you have to be able to convey believably and naturally to make it cosmic horror. You can't just have the argon of fungus in your bees, you know, the second day in say, we are infecting everywhere in the world. It's like, all right, fine, whatever. Because that does, as you say, become trivial and pointless. What you need to do is, you know, draw them in, build them in, while they're desperately trying to find answers. The answers that they find should be scary, not comforting. The answers that they should find is like, oh, well, you know, we solved that problem when it decimated the entire sorghum crop in Africa in 1854. What, in 1854? The entire sorghum? Africa? That seems bigger than my backyard and bees. And then they start looking into that, and it's like, oh, this is interesting. You get the same reports from a carving that was left in Mesopotamia by the Hurrians in 1250 BC. It's like, oh, right, what was happening to the Hurrians in 1250 BC? Well, no one knows, because they went extinct in 1249 BC. It's like, really? Yeah, look at the Bible. It's right there, dude. Really? Yeah. Well, that's not good either. And so if every time that these bees have had a problem, or that there's been this argon bacteria or whatever it is, a cataclysm has happened. See what you're doing there is you're going back in time. You're saying this has a temporal dimension and it goes back in time. You can go out in space, you can go back in time, you can go deeper and deeper and deeper. It's not just my bees, it's my fingernails. It's not just my fingernails, it's my entire bone system and lymph nodes. And it's also of my cats and my wife and my dog and my neighbor, but not my son. What the hell is up with that? And then that's when your son starts talking the buzzy voice of the fungus. It's like, I have made a deal, Dad, you know, or whatever it is. And then and then he says, and bring me to the Hurrians that I may smite them, or whatever it is that you do. And then you've sort of brought up the horror. But yeah, absolutely, you've got to have personal buy-in, belief that the story is relevant to them. I mean, that's why so many Call of Cthulhu adventures wind up being routine and rote. It's like, oh, I have another uncle who died and left me a haunted house. Gosh, who saw that coming? Or, you know, as people who just wander around with shotguns and bad attitudes and suspicion, you sense that this hobo is up to trouble. And, all right, so maybe the hobo is really up to trouble and there's bad news with the hobo, but you have got to bring something in that those wandering shotgun toters will care about. Otherwise, it does become exciting tales of pest control. And the human connection is a great way to do it. And I'm not saying everything has to have a sympathetic victim. Oh, I just found my puppy and then it was covered in bees. Or whatever it is. I'm saying you have to bring some connection to the player, something that they will believe in. And maybe it's just, oh man, I really feel for that hobo. I'll bet that he had a great life. He was a veteran. Look, he's in the remnants of his old World War I uniform. I served in his unit. Or whatever it happens to be. Some connection, some human connection. Because the whole reason we care that the universe goes away is it's bad for humans. And specifically, it's bad for me. You know, that's the real crisis, right? It's that I could end and no one would know. And worse yet, no one would care. And the person who did it wouldn't care, because he wouldn't even be a person. He would be an implacable force of the cosmos. And that's what scares us. But without the part where I'm threatened, and by extension, my cat and my wife and Dana, then not so big, right? If all it's doing is taking out, you know, Ryan, well, that's awful. Yeah, right. Who's moving Seattle? Heck with them. I mean, see what I mean? I mean, you need to make that human connection in the story or in the adventure, and that is one of the great problems with Lovecraft, is because his characters are generally not particularly sympathetic. You occasionally get someone like the narrator of Rats in the Walls, who is a genuinely, you know, interesting human being, or the son in the, you know, Wingate Peasley in Shadow over Out of Time, not the actual possessed guy, but the son of the guy who's possessed is a genuinely interesting character. Absolutely Ward in Case of Charles Dexter Ward. But in general, Lovecraft just cannot develop that. And thank God then he is so good at bringing the cosmic, because otherwise you're not as concerned. You're reading over a guy's shoulder. You know, literally, Call of Cthulhu is a man looks through notes and becomes unnerved. That's the story. Everything else in Call of Cthulhu is Lovecraft bringing it. And literally no one in human history, probably including Lovecraft, has ever cared about Francis Thurston. He's just not that interesting a character, because all he does is read notes. And then he goes to Norway. Thank you, Francis Thurston. Heart-stopping protagonist. No one cares. I mean, you don't care if Francis Thurston lives or dies. You care because what you're reading through Francis Thurston's eyes implicates your existence. It's like, Francis Thurston is literally a clue. He's not a human being. And you can do that. You can certainly do that if you're Lovecraft, or if you've got a real humdinger of a scenario and you trust your players to fall headlong into it. But again, I think it works best if you backstop with something human. You make it something that they're concerned about as people. We have time for one more question if I answer it at that grotesque length.
Are you going to split open and something going to come out of it?
Me?
No.
That's why I sat towards the back of the room. You've got to get out through them. You know, eat them first before I hit the door.
I'm as human as Keziah Mason and Henry Akeley. Don't you worry about me. Why, Dana, your nonsensical concerns make me laugh. Ha ha ha! In your human fashion. Anybody?
What's next? What are you working on? It's Cthulhu.
It's Cthulhu? I don't know. For Trail of Cthulhu, we're going to be doing a book of expeditions. An anthology of expedition-based adventures. There's going to be ways to put together your own expedition so that you can write your own expedition adventure. There's going to be different kinds of expeditions for different kinds of purposes. Written by a bunch of people, I'll probably wind up developing it. I have to write the expedition rules, I've been told, because Robin said not it first. So that's my next thing immediately for Trail of Cthulhu. After that, I don't know, because my current project, Knights Black Agents, which has no Cthulhu but does have vampires. Actually, it's going to have a little Cthulhu in it. I'm going to sneak some in.
The voices haven't told you what's
next. No, the voices have not yet told me what's next on that. So Simon gets to pick the next thing. It might be anything. It might be the much-brooded 21st century Trail of Cthulhu book. It might be any number of things.
Can you mention the smartphone thing?
Oh, I can mention that I am writing Time and Tide, which is a iPhone game from the makers of Agile East. The studio that brought you that will be bringing you Time and Tide, assuming that everything moves smoothly. It will be a tale with certain steampunk elements, focusing on the great race of Yith and Cthulhu. Hence, Time and Tide. They're looking at how Clifford the Big Red God sales do before signing me to write the fourth in the Mini Mythos series, so everyone run out and buy lots of copies of that. Let's see, what else? I believe that I still have the Lost and Lovecraft column in Weird Tales, although Weird Tales was just sold to a new owner, so all bets are off for that. But if I don't, then I can just finish out the series and collect them in a book.
Aren't they suppressing all tales of Cthulhu? There's a reason they're doing it.
That's right. FBI is doing it. And yeah, I think that's all in terms of my immediate Lovecraftian output. Yes, Carl?
And that Lovecraftian book, vampires, you mentioned Knights Black Agents. When will that be out?
That will hopefully be out in a special edition at Dragon Meet at the end of November, early December. And then in the proper full-on edition, its beautiful final form, in February or March of 2012 is the current expectation. Now that my paid shills have completed their
asking. Do you have anything to say about introducing other human antagonists or agents in Cthulhu Horror, whether it's cults or fellow book hounds, or as a I think it's most easily for me to, in when creating role playing games, to create some form of personal villain, evil wizards, or as opposed to a plague. Any thoughts about how to include other humans in the horror?
I think that the other humans are a saving grace of horror, as Lovecraft recognized when he wrote Charles Dexter Ward, when he wrote Thing on the Doorstep, when he wrote even Dunwich Horror, which the humanity of Wilbur Whiteley is a big important part of that story. And Dreams in the Witch House, because Ia Mason is a human being. There's lots of human antagonists in Lovecraft. And I think that taking those humans is another great way to get player connection to the story, because if you can't threaten something they love, tease them with something they really, really hate is another good step. And it's really easy to hate other humans and to give your cultist or your wizard or your evil millionaire or your nasty hobo a habit, a personality trait, a behavior, a way of getting up the player's nose and across and athwart their beam that makes them irritated. And getting them irritated is a good step towards getting them interested. I think that if Cthulhu suddenly becomes nothing more than a fraternity badge or even just a sort of a theological abstraction, if all you're doing is fighting Episcopalians, you're not really, again, living up to cosmic horror. You're basically doing Fu Manchu. Now, Fu Manchu is terrific. I mean, it's a great model. You know, there is a globe-spanning conspiracy made of people who look slightly different than us, and they're mad. That's great. That's a good start. But the thing is, it doesn't really give you that cosmic hit that you are looking for, I think. It doesn't reliably do it. You have to make sure that they exist to deliver horror, that they're a vector for it, not a substitute for it. That they can be a mask on it, they can be a scrim over it, the way that Henry Akeley turns out to be in Whisper, or the way that the mysterious half-mentioned cult that is connected to the Migo, or the one that's connected to the Great Race of Yith might be. That there are human puppets and tools and gloves on inhuman hands, that kind of thing. And once the nature of their opposition is made plain to them in terms of its scope and influence, you know, once you say, oh gosh, everyone in the CIA is on the payroll of this cult of the Esoteric Order of Dagon, you find out that the Esoteric Order of Dagon is actually run by inhuman monsters from underneath Massachusetts Harbor, that's a nice scope reveal. It's like, so really the FBI just sort of took samples like Paul Reiser and Aliens, and that's what's been going wrong? That's not good. How long is this? That was 1928. That's like 90 years ago. Oh my lord, how fast do these things breed? What do they do? Why are there all those reflecting pools in Washington, D.C.? What the heck is going on? What, like, really? Half of the country is owned by the federal government? That seems like a lot of space to put things. And, you know, you can just go there, and you've opened up your thing, and it's because it's connected with a thing human beings actually know, the federal government. They actually feel a little ambivalent about it. Maybe it's okay, maybe it's not okay. I don't know. I can't always trust it. Just like Henry Akeley. Maybe sometimes he's giving you an info dump, and sometimes he's trying to get you measured for a brain cylinder. Anything can go wrong. So yeah, I think human cults are a terrific arrow in your quiver, but don't over rely on them. Don't make the Thule fraternity bad. And you know, worst comes to worst, something that has no human connection really sells it really strongly. And the goal, the sweet spot, is to have something that has no human connection and have a human being who nonetheless has convinced himself that he's connected to it. You know, there's a terrific T.D. Klein novel called The Ceremonies about, it's basically an Arthur Machen mythos story. And it's about a alien thing that falls into New Jersey, and there's a human that is its host, friend, we don't know. And the way that it sort of just cores out people around it, and it's just a really, really terrific look at that kind of thing. Klein is a better writer than Lovecraft in that sort of social sense.
What was that again?
The Ceremonies by T.E.D. Klein. It's an expansion of the events of Poroth Farm. Most people think that the novella is better than the novel. They are wrong. Okay, now we really are done. Thank you for that final question.